sort of antipathy, or I had never been to the coast to live. I'd only been there the one June in 1951 when I went out to meet Rex Ross and Henry Miller. Patchen was living on the coast, and Duncan was living on the coast. Of course, he had been, but I didn't meet him. He was away at the time in 1951. I didn't see him. So I was meeting him for the first time. And I got out there, and I got into this San Francisco orbit, and there was people on there. But I met Michael McClure. I later printed his first book, Passengers. And I printed a book of Duncan's called Letters. And I was meeting with Rex Roth, as I say. Patchen had moved there from Connecticut. So I was seeing quite a lot of him. So I think I stayed out there until about April or May of 1955, and then went back to North Carolina and spent most of that year in and out. You see, I guess I'm one of about three or four people who was born in North Carolina. I was born in Asheville. I was born in Asheville, and Ken Nolan, the painter, and Neil, his brother, a boy named Richard Jordan, was from Asheville. Then this girl named Sue Moore, who's now in Winston-Salem, had been there during the Albers period. She's an artist. I think we're practically the only people from North Carolina that I'm aware of that ever went to the college, because it had a reputation locally as being a center of free love, nigger lovers, communists, right. You know. And my parents were rather appalled when I announced I was going to Black Mountain, because Southern gentry, and it had a very evil reputation. And I, living in Highlands, which is about 100 miles away, one of the people who had been involved in Black Mountain in the 40s was Clark Foreman. Well, Clark was a good friend of mine, and his wife had been a painter who had influenced me to go to study with Knopf's in Washington. They lived in Washington. They had really been sort of bodily kicked out of Highlands earlier, because he was active in the Wallace Party. And Clark's family were very wealthy people. Clark Howell, owners of the Atlanta Constitution and the Atlanta Journal, you know, that newspaper family. Clark was very much the black sheep of the family, and was one of the, you know, was one of the few sort of Southern liberals you ever heard talked about. But they, when he came out for Wallace, I mean, the Mountaineers really just sort of boycotted him. I mean, they weren't, you know, they wouldn't sell them food, and they'd throw rocks at the children, and really just pretty miserable things were being done to them. And so they left Highlands forever. And because my parents didn't like my association with the Foremans, and they didn't like Black Mountain, so it was all sort of touchy there for a while. Of course, they hated the fact that I left Princeton in the first place. They were, so it was, you know, rather unpleasant for them.
Are they still in Asheville?
No, we live, they still live in Highlands, North Carolina, which is about 100 miles away.
Oh, was it? You were born in Asheville?
I was born in Asheville, but I actually brought up in Washington, D.C., but the parents have had this summer place, this farm, orchard, out of the mountains for the last 25 years. So anyway, I was, at times I would live at the college, I had a room there. At times I would go back to Highlands and stay a while, and then come back. The summer of 55, if I'm getting it straight, people was sort of going up and, you know, like small volcanoes, and I was sort of operating a rest home in Highlands for people who were cracking up at Black Mountain. I mean, I'd take somebody over there for a week just to let them compose themselves. People were running off of people's wives, and, you know, it was sort of bad that summer.
Well, there were only a handful of people left.
A handful of people, and the less people, the more intense it all got, and the more difficult. And it was not the world's most pleasant place at that point.
Well, they had abandoned the whole lower site, hadn't they, by 55?
Just about.
The lake and the dining hall and so forth.
That's why people were eating in their homes. The communal life was breaking down. So it really was nothing much left but about six or eight artists with a handful of students. Everybody who could get a decent job at a university, you know, who could teach French like Flo or something, or teach economics or whatever it happened to be, they'd gone off to the, you know, to the academy, leaving Volpe there trying to work, and Olson trying to get some writing done. So it was really getting very vestigial at that point.
Volpe left before it actually closed, though, didn't he? I talked with him briefly. He was already bad shape physically, couldn't talk much, but he said he had left And the fact that he left caused a good deal of ill feeling among the few survivors.
I know there was, he was, well, yeah, I don't know the details. I can't really remember. I know there was a certain amount of hostility between him and several of the people there. I guess maybe they felt like he was deserting them or something.
Yeah.
I don't really remember.
But Dan Rice tells me he has a picture of the very last night at Black Mountain. There were something like 5 or 6 people left, and that's all.
About five faculty and about 7 students or
there were still not many students.
About 6 or 7.
Really?
I know they suddenly, as I recall, the decision was rather quick because, unless I'm getting mixed up again, which is quite possible, Olson was, we were standing in the studies building one night, and he said, why don't we get Diebenkorn to come and teach this fall? So he picked up the phone and got hold of Diebenkorn, and he couldn't come, but like 2 days later the place, you know, went. Just like that. They just suddenly got up one day and decided, well, there's just no money. What the hell are we doing here?
You were still there then at the very end.
Yeah,
56.
I was there.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
No, from the time I came back in the spring of 55, I was
sort of in and out.
I was in and out. I was living at home part of the time. But over there just about all the time.
Well, I've heard some story from a couple of people, in fact, but everybody's very vague, about a guy who appeared at Black Mountain. And nobody quite trusted him, but he stayed, and then suddenly a pregnant wife appeared. And there was all kinds of scandal, and the local police were brought in, and that was a precipitating event that caused the actual closing.
Dear God,
that doesn't sound familiar?
That doesn't sound familiar at all, but I can't even imagine who that is. You don't know any
name? I never heard a name.
I don't know.
I can't recall the details. The last version I had was about a year ago. I have more of it down in print somewhere. He was a very shady character, and I think it was he himself who threatened to blow the place up, not actually, but, you know, expose what was going on. And everybody became so frightened, they decided, well, hell, we have no money anyway, and just a handful of people. And then there was the suit for back salaries and all this.
Well, I know that, yeah. It just seemed like nothing was breaking right, you know. No foundations were giving any money. They would go talk to to Doris Duke, or they'd talk to this one or that one, and nothing was happening.
One foundation sent a bull, I think, and that was about it.
Mm-hmm. I never heard that story. It's conceivable.
Well, when I look it up again, I'll check it and send you.
I can't remember that particular shady character that you speak of. You'd think I'd remember who that was. You see, Landreau was there, the weaver. He might be somebody that you should talk to.
I haven't heard his name.
Well, he was one of the few faculty that was there. Tony Landreau, Anthony Landreau.
Sure.
Landreau, who is now...
in New York?
No, he's in Washington. He's one of the curators of the Textile Museum. Let's see, I can give you that, I think. Tony Landreau. I saw him not long ago. He disappeared for a while. He was having some problems with his drinking and seems to have gotten that straightened out, and he's seems to be okay. Well, you can reach him at the Textile Museum, 2320 S Street Northwest.
S Street?
S.
Northwest.
As in Sautee. Washington, D.C. 20008.
He was there at the very end.
Yeah, Tony was there. He was a younger guy, but he was teaching. Because of Annie Albers, they had a lot of textile facilities there, you know, and a lot of equipment and so on. And Tony was a student of Dorothy Liebes, who was a pretty well-known designer, textile designer. So he was around. So Tony was there. Volpe was there. Wesley Huss was there.
That's right, yeah.
Olson was there. Duncan and Creeley were in and out. Robert
Hessens. Was that?
Mixon.
Elaine Mixon?
Yeah.
I didn't see them. My assistant saw them.
Mixon.
California. I think they were there at the very end. Elaine and Paul Nixon, is it?
Don, is it?
Don may be it. Yeah, I think it is.
Wait a minute. Mixon, is that a composer? No, that's a guy named Cooper.
No.
Mixon, I don't know. Oh, wait a minute. Let's see, is that a guy that's a... that may be a guy who was a woodworker.
I don't know. I never met them.
Yeah, I believe he ran the wood shop or something like that. That's, I believe that's right. He was a... he used to turn bolt, make bowls. Karen Carnes was there pretty much till the end, I think. MC wasn't, but I believe Karen was there. David Weinrib, I believe he maybe took off.
I've talked with him. He was gone, I'm pretty sure.
They left earlier, I think. But I think Karen was around. I don't know whether they split up or what happened, but Karen was there. I mean, you didn't exactly know who was there because everybody was living at home, and some people I wouldn't have seen much of anyway.
I have a little chart that Olson made up in 56, a sort of grandiose fantasy of what Black Mountain was about to become.
Mm-hmm.
The place in North Carolina was the center, and there were ramifying lines to big institutions, presses, all over the country.
Yeah.
So apparently until the very end, he at least still hoped this was going to get back on its feet and become something even more elaborate than it had been. Does that tie in with your own recollections?
I would think so. Charles always thinking, he never thinks little, like they say.
Yeah.
He does think big. Yeah, he had always many notions. And the press was part of it. I mean, I was going to run the press, do the publishing. So that's why I was sort of around.
As late as 56, were there still jarring books coming out from Black Mountain?
They were never, let's see, I don't know whether we ever used that place. Most of them were Highlands. I mean, I used my home as a sort of printing imprint. I think one or two of the books might have said Black Mountain. But obviously I was still very involved with that group. Olson continued to print. Oh, let's see, we did a book, a little tiny thing of his called Anecdotes of the Late War. That was done about 55 or 56. Then, of course, the Maximus, second volume of Maximus came out in 56.
Joggins is really a quite separate history from Black Mountains, isn't it? I mean, in the sense that you were Joggins, and sometimes you were at Black Mountain.
Because I printed... I have printed those people, and I was there for a while, but it certainly was not a house organ of Charles Olson.
Right.
Never intended to be. He was just a teacher of mine, and the one that the most important teacher I ever had was Olson.
Isn't this true to some extent to the Black Mountain Review also? It was published from Mallorca, Creeley editing, but that might have happened even if a place called Black Mountain had never existed. Right?
Well,
the tie-in seems a little more direct there, but I can't establish it.
Olson Creeley, of course, working very close, thinking, involved with many of the same people. There was a group, they had some contributing editors. I believe Paul Blackburn was a contributing editor. Robert Hellman, who was around the college, is a prose writer, a novelist. Hellman, I believe, might be at the University of Delaware. That's where I last heard of him. Hellman could tell you things, Robert Hellman. H-E-L-L-M-A-N. If you look at the Black Mountain Review, I think you'll find stories of his, as well as maybe some things that he brought into the magazine. Hellman, The last I heard of him, he was teaching at Lincoln University, that Negro University, down there near Lancaster, whatever it is. And last time I had a falling out with him, sort of. He wanted me to publish him, and I didn't or couldn't or something. And he got a little angry with me, so I haven't heard from him in years. But I think Kenneth Rexroth, for a period, was a contributing editor. But Creeley had written a piece about Rutke and Dylan Thomas, which Rexroth was furious about and withdrew his name from the magazine. He didn't want any parts of it. But, let's see.
Can you tell me more about Olson as your teacher? You said he was the most important teacher you ever had. And you also said you were with Cummings, et cetera, when you arrived.
I really didn't have much knowledge or interest in the Carlos Williams Pound line of descent, and Olson sort of opened that up for me. And I've been pretty comfortable in that. I found him an extremely enkindling sort of guy. He was probably the most energized character I'd ever run into. Just marvelously quick and responsive, and just sort of like being in the presence of a dynamo. He was just, you got a lot from him at all times. Just his human condition was very attractive to me. And the conversations were endless, as I say, just night after night, day after day. He certainly changed my whole poetic approach to everything, my whole life approach to it. It's so long ago, of course, now that a lot of it's dropped away. But if you look at my work for, say, from 1951 till about certainly a tremendous influence. That's obvious if you look at those poems, say, for 10 years. He was such a heavy, dynamic character that his influence was almost pernicious, in the sense that it was very difficult to get out from underneath all that. He's almost enough to wipe you out.
Much like Albers in painting.
Yeah, it's very difficult to work sort of loose, work out of it. And of course, that was also true of people like, you can't write Cummings-type poetry, you can't write Patchen-type poetry, or Jeffers-type poetry, all these people I liked, very much isolated and sort of encapsulated type writers, as opposed, say, to Pound and Williams, who give you a lot more place to go. It took me a long time to sort of get out from under Olson. And of course, a lot of the other writers always said that I was much too stuck. They didn't like it. Like Zukovsky thought I was being victimized. Rexroth thought so. Dahlberg still thinks so. He says crazy things like, why do you write like Olson and Pound and Zukovsky? I don't think I do. But, I really don't think I do. But I would say it took me almost 10 years before I got, so to speak, my whatever this thing is they call it. My own voice or whatever. I think maybe about 1961 or 62 that started happening.
You said Olson was tough on your early stuff.
Very tough.
Did he come to admire and appreciate the later things?
I really don't know.
So because they were for a while like Olson, or did he admire what was you?
I've heard very little from him. It's as though I no longer have any. I have very little contact with him. We had difficulty. Well, I was to continue publishing the Maximus poems, but we negotiated from about 63 or 64 for about 2 or 3 years, and finally it seemed impossible to publish him because, as far as I was concerned, I was being demeaned. He only thought of me as his soldier boy publisher in Stuttgart, and he was not considering me as kind of not equal, but at least a peer, somebody in the field.
A power poet.
Yeah, I felt he was not doing that, as I felt that Creeley was not paying any attention either. And in this sense, I should say, it's perhaps unfortunate that one is a poet as well as a publisher, because people tend to get confused about how to deal with it. I felt that they were not dealing with me as a poet, which is the way I wanted also to be dealt with. So this is one of our problems. This is why the relationship is pretty well broken down. And so I was not able finally to print Maximus for a variety of reasons, most of them financial, but I simply couldn't get the money together. And I had to work with other people, and somehow it was all too much, and he was giving too little. Not answering the correspondence, not providing decent manuscripts, etc., etc. So you can't fight somebody. If you're going to publish them, you really can't fight them at the same time. So that's why we've... So I have no contact with them at all now. It's very neutral. I have very little contact with Creeley. I have Zukovsky. I found that it was like dealing with something. It's like swallowing alum all the time. To deal with him, it dries you up. I mean, he's just terrible sort of desiccating experience to have to deal with Zukovsky. So I had to give him up. I have almost no contact with, say, Levertov. Duncan, we almost had a war over his book. And
which book?
Letters. It was a very dismembering experience to have to publish that, as it turned out. As I say, I don't think if these things are not necessarily anybody's fault, but it just happens that the way things are with this kind of publishing, either you don't do enough, or you're interested in somebody else, or in other words, there's no winning. There's no winning in it. No matter what you do, it's wrong, and so on. Not trying to sound self-pitying. I mean, this happens if you study the relations that they've had with other authors. James Lachlan tells you about his experiences with Olson, or some of these people, you'll hear the same sort of stories. Maybe we all do that. About the only poet with whom I remain on good terms later is Leighton, and he's a Canadian. Very, very much different sort of person.
How about your own work between about 56 and until the difficulties over Maximus in 63, 64? Was Olson commenting on your poetry?
Very little. Very little. No, it's as though it suddenly didn't exist. And this is something I could do nothing but be offended by. So there's no helping. He decided that there was other people of more talent or more interest as far as he was concerned. That certainly is right, but on the other hand, I mean, he found Wieners to be very interesting. He found Dorn suddenly to be interesting. Leroy Jones, Ed Sanders.
Leroy Jones.
Yeah. And as I say, that certainly is privilege. But on the other hand, I did not like being cast into outer darkness, so to speak, because of my sins, like printing Mina Loy or Buckminster Fuller or something. So it's as though I betrayed the movement or something, you know. But I don't think of it as a movement. I learned a great deal from his method. And it opened up a lot of things for me, but just as concrete poetry is one way, found poetry is one way. His marvelous kind of tension and movement, you know, he's really, again, it's that rhythmic thing that he's got, this tremendous power that he can unleash now and then. I mean, that was very good for me.
He taught me a lot about like Albers in one crucial sense, in the very sense you're talking about. In that, Albers seems to have encouraged all of the painting students to become what they were, whereas Olson seems more to have been looking for disciples.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of mystique about it, you know. He likes, I mean, I'm not necessarily putting him, well, maybe I'm putting him down, I don't know. It got to be a sort of closed corporation, you know. It seemed like it was closing down instead of opening up. You know, all of the sort of coterie. And, I just don't happen to like that kind of approach to art. I suppose the same charge could be leveled at Duncan in a sense, but Duncan is a much more inclusive sort of person. There isn't, again, it's like you're talking about Goodman. I mean, there's like there's a program where there's sort of, you know, there's some sort of way of doing things, you know. There isn't just, you know, it finally end up sort of very, very magical. I mean, arcane, like Gurdjieff or something. I mean, you know, with Olson as, you know, Uspensky or Gurdjieff or something. I don't believe in the way. I really don't.
And apparently, Albers did not. He's able to admire a wide variety of painting and painters.
I mean, you know, Olson's a crucial figure for me. But on the other hand, at one time, I thought Zukovsky was very important to me. Rexroth in a very different way, not so much as a poet, but as a man whose mind I admire, you know, I admire his concerns, his the range and so on. I admire this. So as I say, I've dropped away, or they've dropped away from me, and I've dropped away from them, so I don't have much contact with them yet. and unfortunately, a lot of it was simply over the fact that I was a publisher, their publisher. Levertov, I felt like a very ungracious woman as far as I'm concerned, of just the level of having to deal with her in a business way. Very ungracious. Duncan also. Problems about money and so on. It wasn't so, you know, I live in a way that's not supposed to indicate poverty. I don't like to run around looking like a poet or like anybody's idea of anything. I like to live the way I choose to. This irritates some people. I'm supposed to be a millionaire, a southerner or something. It's just ridiculous. I have much less income than most of them, but and I've done a lot of running about, you know, just to make this possible. 600 meetings, you know, been peddling my ass all over the United States for years, you know, just to universities here and there, just readings. And doing sort of menial jobs as well, like wrapping the books for New Day Press or working in the 8th Street Bookshop, wrapping records in a rock and roll wholesale place in San Francisco. And I've done as much sort of stupid, silly work as they have, if not more.
Well, hell, you were also providing them an outlet when they had no other outlet.
Well,
which would logically look like a source of gratitude, but well, logic doesn't apply.
No, logic doesn't apply in these situations. I say it all. I don't want it to all sound sour grapes, because at the time I had no complaints. And perhaps I didn't have too many either, but it does get to be sort of strange when the only contact is sort of in their minds way back, you know. You were useful once, but we don't need you now, you know. Olson, did you read that text, that speech he made when he was very drunk or very high in Berkeley that they got out of it? In a rather unfortunate pamphlet a couple of years ago. Was it called Olson of Berkeley? Or
Coyote Press.
Coyote put out this thing, which I think is a real, I mean, that's a document that's so bad that scholars will wipe Olson off the face of the earth with this thing. I mean, it'll really be used against him, this thing. But the things he was saying there, I was really very offended by. The way he talked about me, the way he talked about Dan Rice, other people at the college. I really found it very offensive.
In that speech?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
There's some very offensive moments there.
Huh.
And, I don't know, unless I'm psychotic or something, I feel like my motives were and are fairly honorable. As I say, the whole notion was one to establish a kind of community. As I say, it doesn't seem to exist in really, but you can't not believe it or hope for it. So I mean, I'm going to get me some new people to betray me or something.
Well, that's very sad.
Yeah, well, I think it's pretty sad. But everybody tells the same sad story. That's why it's a saving. We have a very sort of meager and silly literary community in this country. You talk to Lachlan, you talk to any of these people. The Golden Goose people can tell you horror stories about the way poets are treated them, so. Or any of the presses. Talk to Dave Hazelwood, you know, the Arhan. It's just very unfortunate. It's such a vestigial and minor art now that it's as though, it's like Rex Roth and Patchen fighting for the last 5 readers or something. It's Miriam Hopkins versus Betty Davis. It's really...
His name is James Dickey.
Well, I think he takes the thing on like it's something that you can win.
Yeah.
You know, fighting for the title. And so he's about won. Now he'll go on to something more important. Maybe he'll become governor of South Carolina or something.
Dickey?
Well, he's now a poet in residence at the University of South Carolina. I bet he goes into politics and wins. he's there to win, you know.
But he's very much a public figure, so
he likes
some sense.
Yeah, he likes to be public.
Yeah.
Hollywood and Burgers.
James Dickey starring as George.
Or vice versa.
Vice versa, you know.
Steve. I saw the new Mallet film last night, Clinton playing Lindsay.
Really?
So why not, yeah.
Well, this is something I don't know. I used to worry about people like Donald Hall, perhaps James Dickey, and Denise, I mean, who really sort of want to be commissar, want to run it, you know.
Yeah.
They want to make all the decisions and figure out who gets the prizes, who wins what. I just don't know. I just don't ever think of it in those terms. I'd like to write a few good poems and have a few people read them that understand what's going on, but that's about all I have any aspirations for. So God knows that seems hard enough.
Have you ever had any connections with Partisan with you?
No.
Because my closest friend is Dick Corey. I don't know if you know his name.
I don't think so.
One of the editors. He's one of the two younger editors that Phillips and Rob more or less turned things over to. And they've resuscitated the review to some extent.
Is it out in Rutgers still?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Dick's the one who brought it to Rutgers because he teaches there. But you sound a lot like him. Some of the things you said.
No, the little bit the problem of, I used to kind of keep up with it when I was around Princeton or around New York, but I've become such a creature of the deep country that I travel so much I don't get subscriptions to anything because I'm never anywhere long enough to receive the magazines. I literally lived in that car since about 1957, when the college closed, I suddenly decided that if I was going to keep doing this, publishing, that things had to get a little bit better. I mean, you couldn't just depend upon the people that you happen to know personally. It seemed like that was not quite enough, you know, which, again, I may have been wrong about that. Maybe I should have stopped where I was. But I got in the car, had this old beat-up Pontiac station wagon of my father's. It was, you know, it was too disreputable for him to run, so he gave it to me. And I loaded the thing up with Grove Press books, New Directions books, City Lights books, Golden Goose, Jargon, all these things. And I started traveling. And I traveled, I think, for 8 months. And I went anywhere in the United States. I used Grove Press's mailing list. And I sent out 5,000 announcements saying that here I had all these books and that I would come anywhere and read if they would just invite me, free. So I got, I think, 82 invitations. I started in Virginia and went through to Oregon. I spent 7 months doing this. And I read 82 times that occasion. And
this was 1957?
Yeah. And I lived from selling books out of the station wagon. I had, you know, just the whole thing was filled with books. And I'd sell, you know, like a copy of the Marquis de Sade in Biloxi, Mississippi. I'd get the salesman's discount or whatever, 20% of it. And I made enough to do it. By selling. And I read all these things. I read Leighton, I read Creeley, I read Olson, I read Zukofsky, and Duncan, and so on, to people that probably would never have heard of them for a long time. And I read myself, not so much in those days, because didn't have very much finished.
You still travel a great deal?
I still travel a great deal, yeah. I don't find myself reading much Charles Olson anymore, but that's that's what's happened. Well, there again, I mean, in those days, it was an apprentice period. I was certainly not a finished writer, and it took me a long time to learn how to write, you know, as well as I do, whatever that means. But now I at least feel like I do it enough, and I've got, you know, like I can read 5-6 hours of me if I want to. But I don't need to read Charles Olson. He's, you know, he's out there doing his own work. And Zukofsky's, everybody's taking care of themselves pretty well. Creeley reads a great deal in public, he didn't in those days. Denise reads all over the country. Duncan does. But everybody was sitting home doing their work in those days, except me. I was running about.
You were not only publishing, but fighting with an audience.
Running about, trying to make this crazy thing.
Did you ever teach? Or think about
no,
it?
Except in this very peculiar way. Like 2 days here and 3 days there.
Well, I was thinking of an actual university appointment so that you could stop traveling and so forth.
Well, the first appointment I got was the Aspen Institute. I was there 18 months as scholar in residence.
Yeah, that's when you first wrote.
Yeah, that's the first time anybody said, you know, sit down and stop, and they gave me the money to do so. And then Maryland Institute this year is pretty much providing me with a place so I can instigate projects with him.
That's why I tracked you down. You never asked how I got your number.
No, I
didn't. Were you surprised?
No.
Well, I dutifully waited through October to hear from you, and at the very end I thought, something's gone wrong. So I called the Maryland Institute, which was the last address I had for you.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, as of November 1st, you can reach him at this number in the office.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't say you'd be there the preceding week. I thought you were arriving the day I called.
No, I arrived on the 28th, a week from tomorrow.
Can I ask you to shift the topic somewhat? I don't think Francine would mind, because she says she was and I think is very close to you, and apparently you share views to some extent while you act like that. But she brought her diary along when we talked. She and I are sort of casual acquaintances anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And she read a lot of the diary into the tape recorder. And part of the diary dealt with Olson as teacher and her own reactions to him. And unlike so many of his coterie, she felt that she distrusted him more often than not. That the references to Maya, Greece, whatever, were very impressive on one level. But if you knew in detail about any single segment of the references, you began to suspect it.
Mm-hmm.
And with her European training and her precision, she especially suspected it.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering whether you felt that as a student or later or not at all, or what your reactions are to all of that. She didn't really think he had the grasp on the material that he was using most of the time.
Oh, well, I'm sure of that. But, I mean, I'm sure that's true. But he was very much, he used to always counter that in a sense by saying, well, you got to take hunches, you got to jump and then see what, you know, you've got to operate as though you knew it, take chances and jump in there and then see what happens uh-huh. later. He was always quoting Werner Heisenberg and the uncertainty principle
yeah.
and Keats's thing about the, you know, the inability to know where you are at any given moment. So.
Well, all that's fair if it's
negative,
negative
capabilities. And I could see how she was, well, after all, she comes tripping down from New York City and kind of that marvelous sort of world of French elegance.
Yeah, right.
And you get this big sort of lurking barbarian from the stub cyclops of Gloucester, you know, sort of laying on some heavy, some heavy pound numbers on our head, you know. Oh, I'm sure, you know. I mean, he does just say some outrageous things, but I sort of like people like that. I mean, I like that kind of attitude.
Yeah, I do too, if they're not simultaneously pretending that they're precise scholars.
No, I mean, there's a place in the Mayan letters where he's trying to educate Creeley about glyphs or something.
Yeah, I just read those.
And he says, you know, he says, oh, gee, I guess apparently I got entirely wrong, but the trouble is, you know, I'm not a historian, I'm a poet.
Yeah.
Whatever, I remember that, yeah. You know, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, you can't combine the two.
That's right.
Something
of that nature. But he did have tremendous, as I say, maybe just his style, which was so fantastic, but this ability to enkindle materials, make things light up, you know, and get hot. I mean, he could really do these things. I mean, I've seen him do it to people and to this kind of tiresome material that, you know, so much of his work is could be just nothing but, you know, some more of the Mr. Whitman's laundry lists or whatever. It's just, you know, just a lot of historical
yeah.
crap, you know. I mean, it could be, if it's left as such, I mean, who the hell would want to read that except, you know, except scholars. I do think that some of that Hittite stuff really sort of stays material, doesn't turn into heat. The song is heat. Well, boy, those are like old dumplings, some of that stuff. I'm not, you know, that's, again, a problem. One of our basic problems, I guess, is the fact that he's always saying that Southerners have no minds, which I suppose is common knowledge. I'm not an intellectual. I mean, I'm just not. The people I like, I mean, the way I operate is you know, that sort of simple-minded Catullan way. I love things and hate them, and that's the way most Southerners, you know, whether they're George Wallace or W.J. Cash, I mean, you know, Cash makes this point too, and it's true. I'm not interested in a lot of his material, but the process is something else. When Olson was right or is right, and when that thing does turn into song, I think it's really extraordinary. So he would probably it would be a basic point. I mean, I don't read enough for him. I'm not that kind of, I don't have that kind of training that he would like.
Well, that surprises me, because I never thought of him as someone who cared a great deal for wide reading or training. I never thought of you as lacking it, but...
I think I lack it in his terms, or maybe. I read for, you know, I read for this horrible word, I read for fun, you know. I read anything if I choose to. I don't read it for classical reasons or something. I read out of enthusiasm. I read for enjoyment, for instance, which is, you know, that's not to be done.
And, really? According to Olson?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Olson only reads for material and necessary things. He never reads otherwise. He never reads totally anything. And he says there are only two books he's ever read from cover to cover, Moby Dick and Ulysses. And the Ulysses just to see what was happening in an enemy camp.
Well, how about when he reads Merwin, or did read Merwin, or now Leroy Jones?
Well, those are poems.
Those he reads for joy.
No. I don't think so.
No, he's a...
Because that is a big thing Duncan talks about. Duncan believes that in reading, just to read, no matter what it is, mystery stories or anything like that. And Duncan has talked before. I remember talking to Duncan's widow about reading, finds and reading anything and anything coming from that reading, as compared to Olson, who on occasion has talked about reading only for a certain amount of information. As soon as you get it, stop. And not reading otherwise, you know, not picking up a book and just reading through it, looking through it. But then that's all theory.
Yeah, of course.
Now, what kind of reading he does or doesn't do.
I mean, I have much more information about painting, much more information about music and other areas than I do about literature. I figure, my God, if I've got to spend my life doing this, I'll pick up what I need to pick up. And I'll get it done sometime, or I won't, you know. But, I mean, I happen to like Satie, I happen to like Bruckner. I have that kind of mind, you know, that just, I like what I like, and he doesn't accommodate himself in that way.
Funny, because I bracketed you with Francine, and her chief objection to Olson was that he didn't have sufficient information. He talked about things as if he did, but in fact he didn't.
Well, he'll throw out some you know, like that summer David Tudor was down there playing the piano. He played the second sonata of Boulez, and Olson makes some remark like, it's the greatest piece of music since Bach. And he probably only heard about three pieces mm-hmm. since Bach, you know. he doesn't know about those things. It's really, he's, you know, barbarian in terms of culture. He knew about Charlie Parker, and he knew about flamenco guitar, and nothing else. You know. He's only been to one concert in his life, and he coughed during the entire thing. I made the mistake of taking him to a concert in London. He's absolutely, you know, wiped out by it. And they're not interested in painting, they're not interested in many things. I'm interested in, maybe I'm interested in too many things. I happen to, it's just a different, just different approach to life.
Well, the kind of remark you made about Bach is, I think, just what Francine meant. She wouldn't have minded if he'd said, I've only heard three pieces of music since
Bach. Well, he wouldn't.
But he pretended to know the whole range and then come and...
Well, I don't think he really covers up his tracks. I mean, I think...
That doesn't count.
No, I mean, if you wanted to nail him, you know, he'd puff on his cigarette and his eyes would get round and he'd sort of laugh and say, you know...
Oh, that's good, yeah.
No, he wasn't pompous. That he wasn't.
Was it possible to talk in his classes? Was there any kind of exchange, or was it just also enkindling the work?
No. He's pretty. He was heavy, but he was back and forth. There was a lot of stuff back and forth. No, I don't.
That's a monologue.
I would never accuse him of. No, I thought he was really tremendous. I would never accuse him of. I was buying most of what he.
Yeah, most of his talking to people is based on that.
He does. He's very responsive. He'll pick up the things. And, He'll dominate you, but that's, you know, just out of sheer size, almost, you know.
Well, he's a formidable presence.
He's just so huge, and, I knew him so well for so long, and suddenly not to know him at all and feel like he'd disappeared is strange. Nothing to be proud of or anything, but as I say, he's dropped away, and I've dropped away. It's odd. But we had few quarrels, and he would take me on my own terms in those days, but that seemed to have changed. You know.
Well, his own personal life has been rough lately.
He's had a bad 5 years, very bad. I mean, his personal life at Black Mountain, I had to escort his first wife away from there.
Connie?
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of, you know, he sort of said, well, look, somebody's got to get her to New York. She's not able to travel by herself. So I did that, and got on the train with her, and, you know, delivered her at the Pennsylvania Station to somebody, her sister or somebody, I forget. That kind of thing. He was having bad times then.
Your second wife was killed, wasn't she?
Mm-hmm. She was killed.
Automobile accident.
I think it was Easter Sunday, 1964. Because I saw Duncan about 2 days later in Chicago by chance, and it just happened.
And then he picked up with a woman I knew slightly. I used to go to a few parties. Hannah Grady.
Once is enough, yeah. I met her.
Yeah.
I met her. The day that I seem to be a chauffeur for these people. I got back from England, went to see Olsen because he wouldn't come to see me. I had to, you know, about Maximus. Went up to Gloucester. This was, 2 years ago, October 66. Arrived. Charles says, if you'll let me pack, I'd like you to drive me down to the Ritz in Boston, meeting Hannah Grady, and we're going to England together. So he cleaned up his apartment by opening the refrigerator and seeing a can of half-empty can of peas in the refrigerator. So he opened the back door and threw that into the yard, and that was cleaning up the apartment. You know, now I'm ready to go. You know, so I threw a few things in the bag, and we had a drink in the tavern. He said goodbye to his son, and Charles, Peter, Garrett Lansing, I think, came in for a second. And that was that. So I took him to the Ritz. The last time I've seen him, I think. 2 years ago. He won't write anymore. I can't get any letters out of him. If I do get one, it's some sort of cryptic scrawl that I can't read.
I got one 20-page one. It took me a whole day to decipher and type it out. And even after I did, I couldn't understand that.
Well, this is an aspect of him, as far as I'm concerned, where I won't go along with. I mean, you can't treat other people like that if you're trying to publish. If you're dealing with a publisher. Or a friend, I don't want. I mean, this is where it does get heavy. I don't think he has the right to do this, and I would complain about this, which I guess he didn't find attractive. No.
Yeah. Well, if you value some other person understanding you, you have to take on the responsibility of communication. Mm-hmm. For example, the letters. I can see why the style is meant to express the man, but if he wants also to have another person understand. I don't mean simplify the poetry or anything crass like that. I just mean in an average communication by letter with somebody you care about.
Yeah, it's that. And I mean, there's the element of arrogance and gets into it. How the hell is a printer supposed to deal with a manuscript that's so illegible that even the publisher can't figure out what to tell the printer? Right. We dropped about $1,000 with a, admittedly, sort of poor type setter in New York, hoping to get this Maximus poems into print. And finally, it was a bad typesetter, but on the other hand, I don't see how he could have done much better with what he was given. And he got all the way to page proofs, and finally it just got ridiculous. He started rewriting the poem in page proofs. This isn't James Joyce we're dealing with, I mean, Christ. Or at least I didn't think it was. I don't know, you know, I don't want to be misused by writers. I'll go at least 50%, if not, you know, 98%. I'm not gonna, but not that last two. They got to come to me. So it's something about that. It's just a whole business of responsibility. So it's unfortunate in a sense. It all sounds kind of bleak. I guess it is, as far as they're concerned. In the meantime, I've taken up with other people and got other concerns of my own, which are quite adequate. No dearth of material to do, or writers to print. So. But it is unfortunate in a way that it's come to what it's come to. Crayley, I don't know whether that tape that you got was something he did for that Detroit magazine, was that thing called Work or something? There was a huge long interview, about a 30-page typescript, you know, of a tape that really, somebody asked really about Black Mountain. This was several years ago. Oh, Lord, now let's see, how do you get hold of that?
Yeah, let me see.
Do you know the, remember the people's
names? The tape you sent Johnson, me was one he made for me, so it's not the same one, but I'd like to see that other one.
This was printed. I tell you who, do you deal with Jim Lowell at the Asphodel Bookshop?
No.
Well, you should, because he's about as good a person as any to dig up this material.
Jim Lowell. Yes.
James Lowell, Asphodel Bookshop. 306 West Superior Avenue.
West Superior Avenue.
Cleveland, Ohio. 44113. And ask him for the issue of Work magazine.
It might also have been Where. They published a magazine called Where, which was a thing I think Creeley was in that. I think it might have been Where it was, which was a lot of lists of publishers, magazines, where people's work appeared, and some Spicer things. But it was Work or Where, I think, and it was John Sinclair from Chicago done. It was a mimeograph thing.
Yeah, it was a very...
He was the publisher, is that
John Sinclair, yeah.
John Sinclair.
But it was, I think, called The Work. Work, but this other thing was called Where, and it might have been two issues of it. Too.
Well, I had a piece...
Sinclair's name was...
I had a piece about Rainer Gerhardt that I don't believe they ever sent me. And this other issue, about the same time, had this long thing with Creeley. That came out just about the same time as this piece of blithering that Olson did at Berkeley, which has so offended me.
Oh, and yeah, I'd like to see that too.
You should get that. Well, he'll have that. Coyote Press did that.
I think you could buy the 8th Street in
8th
New York.
Street,
oh, really?
Yeah, they probably got it.
It's an offset, fairly big thing with a photograph of Olson on the cover.
Frightening photograph of Olson looking like a whale.
What's it called?
Charles Olson at Berkeley, I think.
Charles Olson at Berkeley.
And it's by Coyote Press.
Both of these were about 1966, is
yeah,
that
about right? 66. And I don't know, Creeley was asked about Black Mountain, and 30 pages, and I think my name was mentioned sort of in a footnote once. Again, it was, I felt like history was suddenly being rewritten as though I wasn't there or something, you know. It's like silence is my fate or something, you know, get rid of it. Maybe this is, you know, like very advanced paranoia, but it's
not. No, it certainly doesn't sound.
But I mean, I just felt like suddenly, you know, I was being suppressed or something. I mean, I was there, I did a lot of things. And I wasn't, read it and see. I mean, you know, as I say, there weren't that many of us down there. To hear some people talk, you'd think that Black Mountain had about 300 people in it, and they were all there, but in fact, there was very few people there.
Is there anything else like that that I should see? Because I've never heard of either of these.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so, but I was quite, again, I had scratched my head when I saw this thing in Creeley's, because the implications were that, you know, only John Wieners and Ed Dorn were sort of about. I mean, I didn't suffer any worse than, say, Oppenheimer. Or Stealing Dawson, as you know, you probably know him.
Yeah.
He's up to something.
Well, you know where he's working. He's working for Marché. Just to live. I mean, he's selling furniture.
Is he?
Yeah.
Paul Mosher.
Yeah.
But his
second book, well, his book on Black Mountain.
Isn't he doing a Black Mountain book?
He finished it, but he can't get it published anywhere.
There was a nefarious rumor that Olson
was
trying to suppress
it. Yeah, Olson
was stopping. He told me. He said that he was very bitter about Olson.
Well, I can't see that Charles Olson could stop or start anything in those times.
I can't either. Not a book about Black Mountain.
I mean, he's got no control over Pantheon Press, I should think.
Yeah, well, Fee was a little angry toward me, too, because, in fact, my publisher is Random House, and they had given me a contract on a Black Mountain book, and Fee decided that his book was rejected at Pantheon because my contract...
Random House has Pantheon, now, don't
it's all interconnected. Which, if true, I even asked my editor about it later. Said, you know, never heard of that since then. But I think Fee has got that fixed in his head, unfortunately. He was very reluctant to talk with me. He finally did. 10th of the Times Square. It's a very popular place.